Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust. Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get one full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Prevents 85% of total knee replacements.
85%.
It's bananas.
Evidence-based, yeah. And lasts for 5 years at least.
Those stories are tremendous.
Welcome to Game Recognizes Game, brought to you by Apples Health. You know, it seems like all of us are involved in some type of health and wellness program, maybe disease prevention, or maybe even a longevity program. But these aren't new concepts. They were first introduced to the world over 3 decades ago by visionaries like our next guest, Dr. David Levy, who is an epidemiologist by trade. He actually studied the root cause of disease, and he realized, man, if companies just invested in their employees on prevention programs, they could be healthier, they could be more productive, and the company could save money. Yeah, and guess what? The individual lived longer, healthier, and more productive lives. Not new concepts, but visionaries to bring it to the forefront. Game Recognizes Dr. David Levy.
Welcome to Game Recognizes Game, brought to you by Apples Health. So Webster's Dictionary defines a visionary as someone with original ideas about what the future could be or will be. They simply look at some of life's most complex problems with a different set of optics, create a plan, and try to tackle them head on. And that's what our next guest has done for an entire lifetime, Dr. David Levy, who with his pioneering work in preventative health and also his expertise as a creative thinker and strategist, he has looked at some of the most complex problems in healthcare, created a plan, and tackled them head on. Many wins, some losses, but the relentlessness to just get it right is unsurpassed. It is my great pleasure to introduce my friend, Dr. David Levy. Hey, Dave. Good to see you, man. Welcome here, man.
Thank you very much for the intro.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It was wonderful to read that bio, even though I've known you for a little while, and You've done a lot. And everything I mentioned, those are seeds of greatness, my friend. Those are seeds of greatness. You don't realize as you go through the journey, but at the very beginning, where did it start? Because you went to medical school. You graduated pretty early.
Yeah, I went to medical school. I went to one of those 7-year programs.
Yeah.
From the end of high school. So I graduated medical school. I was 24. And there was a TV program on at the time. I don't know if you remember Doogie Howser.
MD.
Yeah, everybody used to call me Doogie. And then I did my internship in residency. And I looked too young, you know, they wouldn't even sell me alcohol, you know, at the restaurant or the takeout. But I can go and prescribe codeine, or I could prescribe narcotics, but I couldn't.
They were really nice to you then, right?
Yeah, it was a situation. But, you know, I never had this kind of big moment where I was deciding what to do or what not to do. It was kind of expected in my family. My father had been a pharmacist who could not get into medical school for reasons having to do with what happened after the Second World War and only a certain amount of places. So we went to pharmacy as a second kind of thing. So I grew up, I think, in retrospect, with the kind of underneath pressure that if you had the grades, if you had the brains, you know, that's the trip you were going to get on. Mm-hmm. And at the time I was sure, but the truth is, when are you sure about anything when you're 18? I mean, you're sure about a lot when you're 18, but as you get older, you realize you're not. So once I got through medical school, I realized that maybe that wasn't the most interesting thing. And so I let my career migrate in different directions after that in a more, I think, creative way. But I always felt it was predestined.
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, as the wise man once said, you know, if you want to make God laugh, just make some plans.
Exactly.
You know, so you mentioned something about your father. It's interesting. Did you ever feel like he settled being a pharmacist?
No question. No question. I mean, it was the biggest disappointment of his life. And getting, you know, for one of his kids to be a doctor was kind of, that was going to be it, you know, and that was the kind of consolation prize, as it were. Yeah. And in his view, he settled, for sure. And his best friends were doctors as well, being a pharmacist, and sure. He always moved in that circle, as it were. Yeah. And there's no question, it was always settling. And so I feel that going through life, I wasn't going to settle.
Right. That's an amazing, almost crossroads, because once you finished medical school, and I'm sure he attended that medical school graduation, did your relationship change, or did you see that gleam in his eye? And
well, you know, we had a strange relationship. I don't want to go too much into it,
but I respect that.
I will tell you, like, nothing I ever did was good enough, to be perfectly frank. So, you know.
Oh, so you know my mother.
I think they're all cut from the same cloth, as it were. But, you know, interestingly, after I went to medical school, I got a degree in epidemiology, and I was more proud about that degree, the epidemiology degree, because I had to do original research, and you know, it was very, and it was an active choice after medical school to do something different. And I remember my eldest daughter now, who's an epidemiologist, she's in her 40s. She came with me, she was two, she came with me to that graduation, I remember, way back then. So, you know, I never really quite made the grade with him, you know. In his view, and in a lot of that generation's view, being a successful doctor was going to be you were the chairman of surgery or you were the dean of the medical school. But for most of my father's life, he didn't actually know what I did for a living. And he used to sit me down sometimes and he says, like, what is it that you do? Like, could you please explain it to me? Right. And the only time he knew what I did was when I left medical school in my residency and I went into practice for about 10 years because I wanted to understand medical practice before I went into other things. And he
10
understood.
10 years, no less.
Yeah, but, well, you know, once you get into private practice, it's hard to get out. You know, you have a relationship, you have patients, you have to build it up. You can't just close
down. Walk away.
But I held up, put up a shingle. That was the thing, you know. My son is a doctor and he put up a shingle, quote.
He got that.
And then when it migrated, he didn't get that anymore. When I went really into public health and, you know, into kind of bigger population medicine, he never understood that. And he always kind of, I think, looked down on it a little bit because he didn't understand it.
Yeah. Interesting. As an epidemiologist, you know, the study of disease and the origin of disease, after medical school, you got a degree in that. What was it in medical school that maybe challenged you or like inspired you to learn to go into that?
You know, it's kind of like what I found interesting in the medical school curriculum. Like, you know, anatomy, you know, for surgeons, and it was like, okay, it was interesting and like, but I loved basic epidemiology and public health. I loved the history of medicine as courses. I loved all of the things that dealt with not one human, but with, you know, many, many people. And I found it fascinating. You know, medicine is both a cultural and sociologic phenomenon, the way patients are treated and how it's done in different countries. I was really fascinated by that. And so I have to say that I went to do it because it was what interested me the most. And let me tell you, it was not easy because when I was a resident at UMass in family practice and primary care and game plan. All, you know, I was in the ICU and the chairman of cardiology said, no, you're not going to be a family doctor. People like you should be invasive cardiologists or nephrologists.
Specialist.
Right. Especially, yeah, you know, yeah. And I'd say to them, I just can't see myself doing one thing, you know, my whole life. I you know, and yeah. They kind of looked down on me. They kind of said, you know, I took a lower step for somebody, you know, because I did really well in medical school and residency and stuff. And they were disappointed that I had a different point of view, but I just stuck with my different point of view and felt that, you know, I was going to make sure that I was going to be a happy person and I was going to be doing what I love to do, not what somebody else wanted me to do.
You have this mantra in many of these articles written about you that, you know, when something starts to feel like a job, you know, it's time to almost move on and get right. But I see that thread starting to begin there. You know, your father was proud of you, but okay, you did that for him, maybe.
Right.
Right.
No, and, for sure.
Maybe. All right, and then now it's time to make my own path. Yeah. Right. But there was a work ethic, though. You probably still got as a young man from observing your parents, observing your dad. And
oh yeah, the work. You know, my father was a, you know, he built a chain of pharmacies. He worked his butt off, quite frankly. And yeah. I never felt that I had anything coming to me. You know, and the whole ethos was: you get what you deserve, you get what you earn. You know, I was second generation Canadian. My grandparents were immigrants, and they. Little grocery stores and milkmen, you know, yeah. And stuff. And everybody worked. And
you know,
I was just joking when I came here, we're joking about being on time. 15 minutes earlier on time, when you're on time, you're late.
That's right.
You know,
that's
my whole life, you know, and that was the ethos. That's what we all believed in, and you just kept on doing it and doing it.
So 10 years in primary care, right? You had the patients, you put up that shingle. You touched many, many lives, and those stories in primary care are tremendous because you do become a part of the fabric of the family that you're working on, right? And that fabric, in terms of the stories they tell you, that probably had to create some ideas in your head about epidemiology and where you're going to go from there, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue was when you treat individuals, it's a privilege. And it's very rewarding personally for your patients, their families, and for me. But there is a limit on how many people you can help. Yeah. It's just, that's what it is. There's a limit on the people that...
Only so many hours in a day.
Or how many people you can touch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it is. And I was an epidemiologist. I was board certified in occupational health and preventive medicine. And across the road from me was a company called the Western Union Corporation. Now, most people...
Telegram company.
You know that because you may be of a certain age. Now, today, it's a money
I'm 30 years old, young sir.
Yeah. So Western Union was what we call in America self-insured and self-administered corporation, which meant they paid all of their own medical claims.
That's very early in a self-insured market, right?
And they always were. And what most people don't know is that they had... At the time, they were once the largest company in America, telegrams. All those people delivering telegrams.
Sure.
And, you know, they had the largest...
Especially during war times.
The largest number of retirees to active employees, a 10-to-1 ratio. And all of these retirees remained on their health plan. And it was draining the company of money because it cost a fortune. And as you know, lots of money is spent at end of life. And I'm going to tell you, I had people with leg prostheses because they'd lost their legs from gangrene, from delivering a telegram, and a dog bit them. You know, literally, like in the 40s and 50s, and there I was in the 80s, you know, taking care of some of
the dog chasing the postman.
And they invited me in to say, hey, is there something we can do about it? And the thing that struck me when I looked at all of these patients is so many of them were in the medical system getting unbelievably expensive care that they didn't want. People in their 80s and 90s who had end-stage lung disease, and every time something happened, somebody would call an ambulance, they'd land up in the emergency room and they'd turn them around. And I'd go and talk to them and say, just let me stay at home. You know, let me...
Be happy.
Be happy, yeah. You know. And so many of these people were forced into regimens of care that they didn't have the chance to opine on. They weren't given the options. Most of them didn't even know their diagnoses. They didn't know what medicines they were on. Cost a fortune. They all died unhappy. Most people in America do not die at home. 80% die in the hospital. But when you ask them before, most people say they'd like to die at home. And so this was costing Western Union a fortune. And I kind of got inserted inside there, and I created teams with nurses. And we went to these people's homes, and we helped them make choices about what they wanted in collaboration with their doctors. And the doctors were happier, the patients were happier, the families were happier. And guess what? Saved a huge amount of money, and everybody was happy. So this is not these death panel things that, you know, people.
Yeah.
This is about talking to human beings and saying, hey, you know, what do you want?
And offer them the dignity they want.
Yeah, and everybody ought to die without regret, in the sense that they ought to participate in care or treatments that they're not offered, but they're offered, but they've chosen not to. I mean, or not. I mean, people ought to have those choices. And so in about 1989, 1990, I decided to make a business out of it, because the executives at Western Union were really strongly positive on what I was doing. And the HR fellow there went to another company, a big mining company called Amex. And he asked me to do the same thing for them. And I used to go out to Winnemucca, Nevada, and Gillette, Wyoming, where I was told to strip off my suit, because if I walked in there with a suit talking to all those workers, they'd kick me out. So I had to go buy. I went to a tax shop, you know. But I tried to turn it into a business. And so that was the first big digression from primary care, was thinking about how to address all of those people. And the statistic is about 1% of patients in the healthcare system drive about a third of the cost. And it's not always age. Sometimes it's cancer in the middle of life, or bad accidents, or some, you know, stuff like that. And so I decided,
poor morbidity, or
right,
yeah.
And I decided, okay, this is a huge problem. People don't understand it, and I was at all these employers, and I'm going to try and make a business out of it. And that's how this whole thing got launched, and with a lot of happiness, joy, but pain, you know, along the way. But for sure, without the help of other people. Because, well, I'm going to tell you right now, there's no way I'd be sitting here today if it weren't for a couple of people who made, you know.
That's the village, man. That's the village of sacrifice.
That's it, man.
100%. You kind of, you know, glossed over this, but the concept of being board certified at occupational health and preventative medicine, no one did that then. So few did, because the concept and the science of preventative medicine, that was very early in the entire scope of where we are today, number one. Number two, self-insured was also a very new concept,
right?
And also the ability to make or inspire folks to make choices about their health that would pay dividends as they got older. And you, there you were, your first step into much being able to touch many more patients, make an impact on many more patients. So that was I saw that, and you kind of glossed over it, but you were maverick and pioneer right then and there to think about, I'm leaving primary care because I'm limited by how many patients, and now I'm going to be able to.
Right.
Now I'm going to be able to really touch many more people.
Yeah, and my mentor is now deceased. You know, this great guy. He used to see the difference between being asleep and awake. You know, like it was all sitting there. Like, if you understood the data and you looked, it was all sitting there right in front of you. I mean, this is, there's no genius in any of this. It's literally just being awake and looking at what the numbers are and looking at how people behave and seeing what's going on. And as many of your guests have said, showing up, you know. And, you know, I went to the hospital with some of these patients, these old telegram deliverers, you know, and down in South Jersey and with their families, and the stuff that was happening to them, it was appalling. Wow. And, you know, I swear to God, Marty, nobody even asked them. Nobody. I'd ask families, like, what do you want any of this.
Yeah.
This is crazy. This is insane. And I used to go back to the company and say, they don't want any of this, you know. And can I digress?
Of course. Your whole career has been digressing.
When I started the business, my first big customer, I'll tell you how I started the business before, because there's an interesting story there. But once it got going, the first customer was a big company called Ingersoll Rand, and I'll never forget this. There was a teenage son of a line supervisor who had acute myelogenous leukemia, AML, which is universally fatal at the time. A really, really bad disease. And there was an experimental treatment, it was in Wisconsin, called bone marrow transplant. Totally experimental.
What year is this?
92.
Okay.
Okay? And I won't get into names of the health insurance carrier, who was the administrator for Ingersoll Rand.
You mean the devil?
I'm not gonna make any comments. But they refused to cover the procedure. Now, the truth is the CEO or chairman can override the insurer because they pay the claims anyway, you know, and they can insist on something. But this was at the time $100,000, $150,000 treatment, which was a very big number, you know, at that time.
Still a very big number.
Well, you know, well, healthcare, it's not a big number for healthcare these days.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Okay. So the chairman called me, and the chairman said, he called my aunt. He said, look, Dr. Levy, he says, what should I do? You know, everybody's upset. This kid is going to die. He's 17. There's no hope. I said, let me take a look at it. So I looked at it, and I called some hematology oncology colleagues, and I looked at the place. And yeah, it was definitely experimental, but it was promising. And I always, even in business, I always said, if this were my son or this were my family, what would I do?
Everything in your power.
So I went within reason, mm-hmm. You know. So I went back to the CEO and I said, look, I'm going to tell you this is a bad disease and there's nothing, but this looks promising. And he said to me, what would you do if you were the son? I said, I would have him do it. So the company went outside of the plan, told the carrier that it was fully covered. This kid was treated and was cured and went on to get married and have a whole bunch of kids, and it was because of that decision.
Amazing.
So it's not just about saving money. It's really about giving people realistic options and looking at the data and trying to be thoughtful and make sure that they go through life making decisions at life's end, in particular, without any regret. Oh, I should have done this, I should have done that, I should have done this. Yeah. And that was the key thing. And so the kind of reputation it gave our company, which was, no, we're not doing this to cut costs. When the HR executive says it's time to hire, the name of the company was Franklin Health, we gave him, no, it's not just about taking away things from people. The things that we took away, we didn't take away. The patients didn't want them.
Right.
It's also about giving things to people that they otherwise would never have had, like sending nurses to their home, like having conversations with them. Yeah. So, you know, these are important things that they touch individuals, but the challenge was how to make it into a national program.
Yeah. Well, at Franklin Health, I mean, once again, a maverick type company doing things differently, different set of optics, and you were touching many patients at one time. And the concept, you mentioned this beautiful story, young man gets cured. It's a human decision, and I'm gonna digress for a moment, and unfortunately, all these years later, that same decision is now an algorithm, you know, in terms of cost savings and, you know, ROI and,
yep.
and all that, which is unfortunate, but
right.
It was interesting to see how that human decision, you were able to be part of many of those decisions, and Franklin Health went on to become a very successful company. Tell me more about the growth and other stories like that, because you had quite a nice ride there.
Yeah, it was an incredible ride. So there I was. I wanted to make this into a business. I didn't know what a business was. I went to medical school. I didn't go to business school. So I had a friend who had started a successful business in Washington. And I said to him, look, I want to turn this into business. And he said, you need something called a business plan.
Oh, that pesky thing?
I said, what's a business plan? He said, I'll write one for you. I said, okay, that's a really good idea.
You couldn't Google it then, right?
couldn't do a ChatGPT on writing your business plan.
You get a really good one now.
And I made him a lot of money. Because that was a fair, you know. So I get this business plan, which was kind of described what I wanted to do. And I wrote it up. And I said, okay, now what do I do with this? So I thought that somebody who would really like this would be a health insurance company. Yeah. And one of the rising stars at the time in 1990, late 80s, early 90s, was a company called US Healthcare. I don't know if you remember it.
I do.
It was HMO Pennsylvania, HMO New Jersey. And the chairman and CEO, was a founder, was a guy called Len Abramson. So I said, I'm going to send my plan to the chairman of U.S. Healthcare. I was a big U.S. healthcare provider in my private office, and they were very good to me. And I liked what they did. I liked their approach.
This is also very early in managed care.
The beginning.
HMO.
Like,
Health Medical Organization, I think I have that
right. Means,
yeah.
Right. And that was when they were really doing great stuff.
HIP, U.S. healthcare.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, group health, Quabra, all these. So on a Friday, I overnighted to him, you know. Tuesday morning, so he must have received it like on Saturday or Monday. Tuesday morning, I'm in my office examining a patient. My nurse is there, got my white coat, probably gloves on or something. And the secretary knocks on the door. She says, excuse me, Dr. Levy, there's a man on the phone who wants to talk to you from U.S. Healthcare. I said, well, I'm busy with a patient. What's his name? He says, well, it's Mr. Abramson.
CEO.
This guy's running a billion-dollar company. He's running a billion-dollar company. I said, whoa. So I excused myself, took the call. He said, thank you very much for your business plan. Never seen anything like this. I want you to come up down to Bluebell, Pennsylvania, where there was their head office, and I want to talk to you about this. Next week. So I take a day off. I go down to Bluebell, and I sit down with Len. I said, call me Len. And he grills me.
Call me Len.
Blah, blah, blah. In his big office. I mean, this is a $1 billion company.
Yeah.
So, at the end of the day, he sits me down and he said, you know, I was so interested in your plan that the reason I pulled you down here is because I'm looking for somebody to head up a new division and you'd be perfect. But after talking to you, I see the passion in what, you know, you want to do. He said, I'll write you a check right now for $1 million for 90% of your company. He said, but David, I am going to make you miserable for that $1 million. I am going to drive you crazy. If you were my son, or my brother, I would tell you, walk out of here and go and do it on your own because you will be successful.
He was honest.
Go out and do it on your own. And that's the last I ever spoke to him. I sent him a thank you note, and he went on to do great things. He, you know, multi-billionaire, started the Fox Chase Cancer Center, and I went out and found a partner, and, you know, who luckily had the same attitude towards young, creative people and didn't slam the door and, you know, wanted to listen. And those are the people you're grateful to.
That is an opportunity. The honesty is the opportunity.
Honesty, but also to invest the time.
Sure.
You don't usually see that. And in today's world, you know, it's one of the big lessons.
The generosity of time.
Yeah. I always take calls. You know, I was very senior in lots of organizations. I see all these executives, man, below me, two levels, three levels, they don't take calls. I take calls from kids. I look at business plans for free because I'm always learning, I'm curious, and they're the future, man. And if
you might get a flood of business plans after this episode airs.
I don't mind. I do it all the time. Just got one yesterday.
Yeah,
you know, and I will always do it because if somebody didn't do it for me, there's no way I'd be where I am.
I could not agree with you more. We've talked about this before. The chances that I got, and they were just a couple of chances I took full advantage of, but I will never forget those people who gave me those shots, those little shots that I knew that I don't take advantage of this now, I ain't going anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go back to a business plan. So you sent out your business plan. You sent it out to U.S. Healthcare.
Yeah.
What was your mission statement on that business plan? Because that's where it all starts in a business plan.
Yeah. So the vision was essentially to address the 1% of the patients that were driving 30% of the cost in ways that had never been addressed before, and to improve their lives and their, like, the human condition around, you know, these people, and so they could live happier, healthier lives. Half of those people, what we call I invented the word, the complex patient. People don't know that and I don't advertise it, but I remember the day with my top epidemiologist, we invented the word complex. It used to be called catastrophic care.
Mm.
We actually...
Terrible spin on that one.
Terrible. It's like, 'cause everyone is a catastrophe. It was complex. You know, multiple, single, usually main diagnosis, multiple comorbidities, lots of things going on at the same time. So we invented a new way of looking at those patients. We had a new kind of care plan methodology, a new medical record, and we called it the complex patient. And so our view was, the vision was to improve the lives of those people, and the mission, you know, was to kind of use the access of large health insurance employers, you know, to access all those people. Yeah. And that's what we did. And eventually we ended up signing up large health plans and it became, you know, a big national company.
To manage complex care for them.
Complex care, because nobody was doing it. And, you know, after Len told me to go do it myself, I then found who ended up being my 50-50 partner, who's since died. He was a retired president of IBM. My kids know and everybody knows because he literally drove me insane for 5 years of my life. He was the toughest guy I've ever met in my life.
And he became your partner?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And against the advice of a lot of people.
Sure.
But you know, it's really interesting and it's a big lesson in life to understand when somebody is pounding you, not to make you smaller, to make them taller, but to make you bigger.
Yeah.
And one of the things in that relationship was every single thing he did was to make me bigger.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365 because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
And he felt he only had a certain amount of years to do it.
Yeah.
And man, I was the victim or the beneficiary.
Or the beneficiary, right? Because we talk a lot about this on this show about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. And that's exactly, sounds like what he did for you.
Marty, my first week we launched our first contract with USORAN. He made me so afraid and anxious, I got a facial palsy. Bell's palsy, yeah.
You're a young man to get that.
Yeah, I was in my 30s. I was really off the charts anxious because I was still in full-time medical practice. I was doing this at the same time, you know, all this stuff was going on. And this guy, you know, and everything I learned in business, he taught me. Everything.
I love it.
Everything.
I love it.
And it was, you know.
You know, the concept of complex patient, because in my training, I was able to work on many of the teams that handled the complex patient. But it always reminded me of the sports medicine team, because that's, you know, my world. You know, there's a myriad of specialties in any given team, college, university. You know, you have the team physician, you have the associate team physician, you have the physical therapist, athletic trainer, certified strength coaches. One myriad and discipline after all working together for the welfare of that athlete.
Right.
And the complex care patient, the complex patient, reminded me very much of that. It forced disciplines to communicate and be accountable for their little domain.
Listen, people, this is not a soundbite, so a lot of people don't have the time to listen to it, but human biology is not linear, it's not deterministic. This is what I learned doing mathematical modeling, you know, for epidemics. Human biology, by its very nature, is a big mass of complexity, kind of rolling down a hill. You know, you look at the COVID, you know, and all these mutations, and you look, I mean, everything. So to think that you can algorithmize, for example, any single human, it's insane, because there's biology, there's physiology, you know, there's genetics, then there's personality, then there's culture, then there's sociology. I mean, you know, medicine is a very complex thing. And the way people look at health is different all over the world. And you have to approach it from a point of view that says, wait a minute, I'm not going to lecture you about what's good for you. I need to understand what good for you means to you.
Which is subjective.
And by the way, that goes from sports to cancer treatment.
That's right.
To end of life.
That's right.
It's not me to judge what's good for you in medicine. My job is to listen and to make sure that I'm satisfying your requirements without, you know, kind of any judgment around it. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard, particularly in medical school where you're kind of socialized not to be that way. You know, the whole medical school thing is a very hierarchical kind of situation. And you
first
know,
year, second year, third year.
And then who does what and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's
the
like
residency you get.
And, you know, it's a very difficult thing to get out of that mold and to start to really listen to people.
Interesting. You mentioned, you know, it's subjective conversations. You can't put subjectivity into a ChatGPT. You can't put subjectivity into an algorithm, right? And that's what folks forget about the delivery of healthcare.
Yeah, today in healthcare, everybody talks about AI.
Sure.
So to be truly heuristic in AI is really to invent new things. But the truth is, all of the things that are invented have come from existing things that have been found somewhere. I wrote an essay about last summer about healthcare and how it's falling apart and this, that, and some suggestions.
It just started falling apart.
It's falling apart. It's very sad. So I wrote this essay. And I sent it to somebody, a friend, and you know what he does? He puts it through an AI thing.
Yeah.
Pretend that you're, you know, president or, and how would you criticize it? Well, I get back, you know, 20 AI comments on the criticism of this essay, which is actually exactly why I wrote the essay. Because that's what everybody has been saying for the whole time. Nobody, that module could never kind of, it wouldn't have the capacity to think through the problem by twisting the cube. It just wouldn't have the capacity to do it because that's not where, you know, kind of the information came from. Yeah. So it was a real lesson in what the limitations are. And I don't know, they say that AI someday is going to have independent decision making. And it's going to be heuristic, it's going to create new things out of something. And maybe that's so, you know, and maybe, but, you know, I don't particularly think that creating a drawing by saying you want this, this, and this, and this, you know, on your screen is necessarily new, novel, and creative. But, you know, you listen to some of these relationships with people with bots and stuff. I mean, maybe it's getting there, but right now I just think that the soul, personality, everybody's different.
Absolutely.
Everybody's different.
David, now we're going to do a segment that I just love. It's one of my favorite segments. It's called Moving the Chains, and it's sponsored by Noble. You know, a footwear brand just designed to help their customer and all of us reach their physical goals, the mental goals, and emotional goals. And when we designed the concept of Moving the Chains, it's a football, you know, name, you know, that first down, which is only 10 yards, but it's a small win. It's a moniker for life. You know, you have enough small wins, you're having a pretty good day.
Right.
Right? And with you, with your passion in preventative health, what is a non-negotiable that you do every day to help move the chains for you?
You know, excuse me. I religiously, every single day, every morning of the week, 7 days a week, I do 1 hour of aerobic exercise. I swim between 3,000 and 4,000 yards, or I run a 10K. And people think I actually do it for my body, which I would say is probably a secondary beneficiary of it. But what I really do is I think about the day that's coming up. And it's the only time where I'm with no devices. So, you know, I was swimming this morning in the pool. I thought about you. You were in my...
Thank you.
In my morning. Well, no. I would think all about my meetings for the entire day. I would think about what I was going to say, how I would approach it. No notes. No. I would think about what was going to happen that day so that when I showed up, I would be mentally prepared. So I use aerobic exercise as a mental preparation exercise. Other people do yoga or they do other kind of, but for swimming in particular is a unique situation because it's anti-gravity. You know, and it's stretching and it's very rhythmic breathing.
Sure.
And so you can kind of get into a zone where you can block most things out and you can have pure thought about what that day is going to bring. And if I don't do that, I'd say people around me would notice if I missed that day, because I just wasn't right during the day. I didn't think it would be as calm, you know, or relaxed. And you know, I used to run ICUs, you know, as a resident, intensive care units. And, you know, people, no blood pressure, kids, bad things happen, car accidents, suicides. I mean, babies being born, heart attacks, cardiac arrests, you know, and you have to have your mind, you know, you have to be in a zone to be able to do that. And in business, you know, people would come in, they'd be freaking out for some, frankly, bullshit thing, you know, and I'd say, wait, everybody stop. Like, explain, tell me who's dying here, like, right now. You know what I mean? Like, what accountant is dying, you know, or what, you know, banker is dying, you know. So I think getting into a zone, and for me, it's that non-negotiable one hour every day for my head and for my day.
Well, now you're going to get a pair of Noble shoes that are the most comfortable pair you've ever had.
Good.
And that 10K is going to be that a little more softer, a little bit more comfortable.
Good.
It sounds like our friend Dan Orlovsky, NFL analyst,
yeah,
he gave us a line during his episode. He said, I have to earn my day.
Yeah.
You know, and that is exactly what you described. You earned your day with that, you know, that hour of aerobic activity.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I never commuted in my life. Ever. I refuse to take a commute job because that hour in a train or a car would be the trade-off for that hour.
Yeah, yeah.
I never commuted. And whatever it took, I, you know, if I had to get an apartment or whatever, you know, close to, that was it.
Well, that is a gift, right? All right, let's talk a little bit about Franklin Health was a maverick company dealing with complex patients. It was also the beginning of the managed care world.
Right.
And 30 years later, maybe 40 years later now, we're still dealing with the concept of affordable healthcare for many. And managed care essentially failed on many levels, may have provided access to many, but the costs keep rising, and 80% of our $3 trillion healthcare budget in this country is spent, as you mentioned, in the last 2 years of life. Where did we go wrong with trying to manage healthcare costs in this country? Where do we go wrong with managed care?
So you're asking a really big question that people scream and shout about all the time. And unfortunately, it always gets politicized. Mm. Socialism, communism,
one of the isms.
Yeah, yeah. So the truth is, this has all been done before, elsewhere, and much better. So the American healthcare system, as you probably know, is falling very much behind. It's failing in many regards. You know, in general, we know what it costs to produce things around the world. You know what it costs to produce a car, or the inputs in it. And there's not a big variation. You know what it costs to produce an accounting audit around the world, or a software platform, you know. And healthcare is pretty much the same thing. In most developed, and even some moderately developed economies, we know what is spent. It's about 8.5% to 12.5% of the national wealth, of the GDP, to get a certain amount of outputs, which is everybody's covered, certain amount of infant mortality, maternal mortality, disease parameters, this, that, or the other thing. Well, America is the outlier. So actually, last year, I think we spent close to $5 trillion.
That was off.
And when you compare it to every other country, it's about $2 trillion more than you would expect. $2 trillion more than you would expect.
And the outcome's not much better than anyone.
And you would think that for that $2 trillion, we'd be getting something better. But the truth is, with that $2 trillion, we do far worse in almost every dimension in healthcare in this country. So $2 trillion a year is sloshing around our system doing absolutely nothing. And the reason I bring this up, because one, it's an enormous number, and two is think about what $2 trillion could really do if there was everybody was covered. But the reason I bring it up is that healthcare has turned into a fight about share of that $2 trillion. Whether it's private equity or health plans, everybody wants a piece of that good for nothing, $2 trillion that's floating around doing zero.
And that pie has gotten too big.
And that is what healthcare has turned into, a financial powerhouse trying to garner as much of that excess cash. And you know where it lands up. It lands up into a few pockets, you know, who understand the system and know how to manipulate it. You know, and I've talked and written a lot about it. It's not about single payer, you know, and it's not about some, you know, because countries all over the world do it differently. Some have single payer, some have multiple payers, lots of them have private insurance.
Or national health care.
And let me tell you know, I have kids born at the NHS, you know, granddaughters born in the NHS with significant problems, with IVF and everything. They get way better care, despite all the problems with the NHS. It's not even a contest. I mean, you're an athlete, you know, 2 years ago, a woman, a gold medalist from Brazil Olympics, died pregnant in America. This would never happen anywhere else but America. A gold medalist, I think she was a gymnast or volleyball player, she died pregnant. It's an outrage. It's a
absolute travesty.
Outrage. And so, you know, in the end, how could we tolerate that? It's like we accepting to buy cars 50% more than they cost in Canada or anywhere else with no warranty. What we go along with here in America in terms of quality and expectation in healthcare is just amazing. And we have fallen so far behind. And I think it has to do with the fact that there's too much money floating around.
Yeah.
So one of my friends who used to run HHS used to say, the problem with healthcare is there's too many one percenters in healthcare. There's two, everybody says, oh, we need more money in healthcare. You know what? It's bullshit. Healthcare in America is overfunded and inappropriately allocated, and it's structural. You can't blame a health insurance company for wanting their piece. There's for their shareholders. You can't blame private equity for, you know, that's not what it is. There's structural problems.
Yeah.
And if you solve the structural problems, you look at the root cause, we wouldn't have the problems that you're talking about. And these are all derivative problems. So, you know, my whole life I've looked at complexity. This is not complicated. It's been done before. It's been solved before.
The pie got bigger and it got simple to almost fix it. It's almost simple to fix it.
Now, there's political issues to fix it, you know, and we won't get into the details of it, but it is fixable and it's done before, you know, and anybody who thinks it isn't, you know, I liken it to the, maybe you've heard me say this, it's kind of like the passenger rail in America. I mean, you know, Amtrak's like the Acela is the best we got. you know, all you have to do is go to Asia and Europe.
Ride a bullet. Ride a bullet train.
Baby, and you know
what a real
we're screwed up. Well, these days, all you have to do is experience healthcare in another country. And you realize, I ran the global healthcare business for PwC. I started healthcare business in 30 countries.
Yeah.
There's nothing that anybody, that America does any better than anybody else, and many are far superior in terms of quality and the like. People don't know it. At the Olympics this year in, where were the Olympics again? In Paris. There was
Summer Olympics.
There was Summer Olympics. This year, there was, I think, a gymnast or somebody was going on Instagram saying that she was stocking up on all her preventive health, all her checkups, everything, because she couldn't get it in America.
Yeah.
And I have friends who are expats. It used to be 20 or 30 years ago, they used to come to America for healthcare.
Yeah.
Now they wait to go home.
Yeah.
It's because it's accessible, it's affordable, and it's high quality.
And you were there at the forefront of preventative care, my friend.
And it's no longer here in America. It's not where you go.
There's no money in preventative care. You know, two things I want to go about. I want to fast forward a little bit on your career, but before we get there, you talk about this pie getting just way too big. We went from $3 trillion to $5 trillion, and now it got even bigger with the GLP-1 drugs that making a much, adding more, you know, financial gain for many. However, I'm always the optimist, and I think the opportunity to decrease some of the core morbidities that have a real impact on core morbidities, I'm excited about it, but I know that excitement has some issues there too.
Look, by the way, these GLP drugs are transformational. And in terms of improving quality, I mean, it's now we don't know exactly the long-term effects.
Not yet.
We don't know how long people can stay. And I'm not talking about that. I'm saying when you just look at the evidence right now, its impact on some of the most important and expensive diseases in America, diabetes, cardiovascular illness, and obesity, and all of, you know, it's dramatic. But for me, and we'll have to figure out who gets them and for how long, yeah, and what the right, and that's going to evolve with
and time. So much of off-label use as well. Yeah.
Well, the compounding, you know, or yeah, off-label. Yeah. But let me tell you what the problem with those drugs are. You, the same drug company, sells the same drug in Europe for $60 a month and charges you and me $1,000 a month. How, excuse me, can I swear on this show?
Yes, you can.
How the fuck up is that? Okay, yeah. 60 versus 1,000. I used to take Crestor.
And then again, only the 1%ers can get that.
Well, and then, of course, you have a big political thing. I mean, yeah, you're going to spend $1,000 a month on 30% of the population in Medicare. What, are you kidding me? It breaks the bank. Let's have a conversation at $60 a month. you know, I used to go to India and get my statin for 5% the cost, for 50 rupees. 5%. I used to get 2 years' supply for what I would pay.
At the airport.
No, I used to get it, same drug company, in the same wrapping.
Amazing.
And, you know, it is ridiculous.
We could talk about this forever.
It is ridiculous. So, you know what? Let's address the core issue. You know, I've always said, the only innovative things really in healthcare, at the end, is drugs and devices. That's it, is biology.
Yeah.
And physiology. Everything else is kind of stolen from other industries, whether it's process and all this kind of stuff.
Even procedures are usually just old procedures done a little more efficient.
Yeah, but drugs and devices, you know, GLP-1s, that's a true innovation.
Yeah.
You know, and because of fake pricing and ripoffs.
Part of the problem.
It's making it inaccessible to lots of people and creating discussions here that ultimately will limit its availability.
Yeah.
Bad.
So we went from Franklin Health, PricewaterhouseCoopers, executive health companies. And I want to fast forward to where you are today with Apples Health, which is a company that I'm so excited about. And, you know, full disclosure, they are the title sponsor of our podcast, but I wouldn't have selected them if I didn't believe in the science behind this company, this foot-worn medical device that essentially allows people to finally treat chronic knee and back pain based on simple biomechanics, allowing the muscles that normally shut down, right, due to chronic inflammation, to engage again, to give them the support, the stability, and the confidence to go about their life again. That's what's so exciting about that company. And I know you wouldn't join forces with just any company.
It's not just a shoe. It's an innovative, personalized treatment for your body designed to relieve knee or lower back pain and get you moving better. Apples, precisely what you need.
Yeah, that's a crazy story. I had left PwC, I was about to do something else, and a friend of mine said, you got to go look at this company. It's some shoe thing, you know, it's if you want pain, they start to walk again, blah, blah, it's Israeli, and all of a sudden I'm suspicious, you know, and I don't know. And, you know, I met the founder, and the founder is a very compelling guy. He's an Israeli fellow called Avi Elbaz, an orthopedic surgeon. I said, this is too good to be true.
Yeah.
So I went to Israel.
I thought the same thing.
it's impossible not to think this is too good to be true. It's the biggest problem with the challenge. I went to Israel, and I met with all the IP lawyers. And I met with people, and I watched Dr. Elbaz treat, you know, patients. And it was fascinating. And I saw these videos. I said, this is unbelievable. This is a completely different way of looking at the problem. I call it the problem of gravity. You know, we are in a relentless fight our whole lives against gravity. I mean, that's what it is. The whole axial skeleton is fighting gravity. And
father time and mother time.
Gravity does not help, I have to tell you. Gravity does
not. So
I looked at this, I said, this is unbelievable, you know? And the more I looked at it, the more convinced I got. And then the private equity company from Israel asked me to take it over and bring it to the US, which I did, changed the business model, was losing a fortune. And that was 11 years ago. And I brought it here, I ran it for a few years, and then when a fellow who worked with me, fantastic guy, surgeon, Dr. Cliff Bluestein, who you know,
yeah,
He took it over in 17.
Impressive person. So impressive.
Yeah, he's been, and you know, this is a perfect example. There's no such thing as failure. It's just giving up.
Yeah.
And we just stuck at it, you know, because I personally believe this will be the new standard of care for diseases of the axial skeleton and others, you know, female pelvic diseases too, you know, it's very effective. So we did studies when I got here. We did studies with some of the major medical centers. We did, now we have, you know, really great controlled studies, evidence-based, you know, peer-reviewed journals all over the world.
And you have FDA approval.
And FDA approval. And now we have 20 or 25 million people under coverage. And this thing will be the standard of care, in my view. And it's too good to be true. It is simple and it's brilliant. And you're right. What it does is it creates, it straightens the axial skeleton, it creates the right vectors to immediately take you out of pain, and then retrains the way you walk.
That's
and
right.
You have to wear it in like an hour a day. And to see the videos of some of the, I mean, you've seen them. It is totally ridiculous.
Yeah, they almost look like actors, but they're not.
But you know, when people ask me about it, you know what the struggle is? Like, should something like that take 11 years? Seriously.
Right.
11 years, and the payers, and the convincing, and the, and by the way, the whole medical industrial complex that wants to do $50 to $100 billion of total knee replacements every year, when this prevents 85% of them.
Yeah.
You can imagine the forces and the
powers.
Say
that again. Prevents 85% of total knee replacements.
85%.
It's bananas.
Evidence-based, yeah. And lasts for 5 years at least, because now we have ongoing studies. Well, you could imagine there's a lot of people who might not like that kind of money coming out of a $50 to $100 billion total knee replacement industry or low back industry, which is even more. So, you know, and I just tell you, you just get up in the morning, you just keep on whacking away at it.
I love the fact that I get a chance to just simplify it and have the average consumer understand what it does. And the bottom line is chronic pain, whether it's knee or back or the hip or lower extremities, creates chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation shuts down muscles that you need to do go about your day. And that's what this foot-worn device does.
Right.
It just it helps those muscles engage to give you that sense of confidence again. And that is as invaluable as you can possibly get. And I'm proud to be part of it. I'm so glad you're at the helm there as chairman of APHIS.
I'm not chairman. I'm just on the board.
Oh, okay.
Somebody else is chairman.
You got demoted? I'm kidding.
No, I was never chairman. I was the CEO, and then I got somebody else to do the CEO. I'm still on the board. I'm an investor, for full disclosure, so I don't want to, you know,
want
people to think, but
I'm proud to be an ambassador. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're proud to have you as ambassador because you understand the pathophysiology of what it really means. And I'll tell you, you talk about luck in companies. The first health plan I sold, the chief medical officer was a board-certified rehab doctor.
Wow.
Physical medicine and rehabilitation. And the only reason we sold it is because he took the time to understand the physiology of what we were trying to achieve, just like you.
Well, honored to be part of it. And the science is, as a geek of sports medicine and orthopedics and biomechanics, I get it and I love it. I'm excited for the company and where it's going. All right, let's get 2 minutes on the clock. David, here we have a wonderful segment we call the 2 minute drill. We give you questions, you give me one word answers. You don't have to think too much about it, but they're fun and get you thinking a little bit. Okay, your workout this morning, what was the first song that came up on your playlist?
I don't do playlists.
Oh, come on.
I'm not kidding.
So when you put on music, where are we going, sir?
Well, in general playlists, you know, I kind of like the traditional 80s stuff. I'm like, but my favorite song is Build Me a Buttercup. That's a true story.
I love it.
It's a family song by the Foundations.
That's fantastic. And I hear it in my, I hear it in my head now. I'll probably be listening to it all day.
But, you know, one of the things about exercise on purpose in the water, no playlists. When I run with the dogs, 10Ks, no playlists. I want to hear nature.
I love it.
Yeah.
There's your soundtrack. Nature.
Yeah, nature, the birds.
Best advice you ever got from a mentor?
Over next.
Mm. Turn that page.
Came from Norman Lear, but two of my other mentors.
Over. It's over, period, next. I love that. Just turn that page.
You know, it's
that is a moniker for life. Little kids can learn that. It's over. That bad incident, that bad play, that strikeout, that missed basket, it's over. On to the next. I just love that. And our last question, a little more reflective, we call it thoughts from 30,000 feet. If you had the privilege of sitting with your 18-year-old self here, what would you tell him?
Chill out. Less anxiety. You could have probably gotten where you wanted to get to without having had to torture yourself quite as much.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know.
You probably didn't have to torture yourself that much.
That's why you led with chill out.
And I, you know,
it'll happen when it happens.
It's not what you will make it happen, but you have to inherently believe that you're on the right path. You have to be aware. Of what's going on, but you don't have to kill yourself.
Yeah.
You don't have to do all of the collateral damage.
Well, let's
chill out.
Let's go chill out together. I can't thank you enough for being here, man.
Thank you.
It's an honor. I'm proud to call you a friend, man. Thanks for being here, buddy.
Thank you, sir.
Good to see you.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.